Good afternoon. Can you all hear me in the back? I'm Donald Horowitz. I'm a Stickered Distinguished Visitor at the LSE for this month. And I've been dragooned, but quite willingly, I must say, into moderating this forum on the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The forum is held under the auspices of the LSE Irish Society, and I'm delighted to see that there's a nice turnout for this for discussion of this important issue. We'll proceed in the following way. Professor Brendan O'Leary will make the opening remarks. There will then be some comments by Professors Fred Halliday and Rob Farr. I may mumble an incoherent thing or two after that, if there's time. We will break at 2 o'clock. If there's interest in continuing past that time, we'll go on until as late as 2:30. I myself have to leave at 2:20, so that my moderating responsibilities will end promptly at that time, but by then I'm sure that the proceedings will be sufficiently underway that you won't need any moderator. You probably don't need one anyway. So I think we ought to begin promptly by asking Professor O'Leary to educate us on the meaning of the Good Friday Agreement.
Thank you very much, Don. I can't promise that I'll educate you, but I'm certainly going to behave this afternoon in full anorak academic mode. And the anorak mode is necessary to explain some of the complexities and subtleties of this agreement. The first thing I must say about this agreement is that it's not the third way. Contrary to what Charlie Leadbetter allegedly said at the feet of Tony Blair, I think it was at the feet of Tony Blair, the Northern Ireland Agreement is much more interesting than the third way and much more fascinating. So what kind of agreement is it? It is most obviously a consociational agreement. That phrase is correctly associated with the Dutch political scientist Arend Lijpaart. A consociational agreement is one in which there's an agreement to share executive power, to grant public offices on the basis of proportionality rules, to ensure that each community is equally and fairly in charge of those matters of cultural life which are of profound importance to them. And lastly, a consociational agreement is one in which minorities get veto rights and veto powers. The agreement is certainly a consociational agreement, but it's many other things as well, many of which we will, I hope, have an opportunity to discuss. The agreement combines consociation with complex elements of confederation and federation, which I'll hope to explain. The agreement creates a role for both governments to, in effect, pool and share their sovereignty both now and in the future. And the agreement creates a very subtle double protection model. It protects communities whether they are majorities or whether they are minorities, and it protects them now and in the future. Lastly, the agreement rests on a hard-headed bargain, a hard-headed set of calculations by both nationalists and unionists. And the question I think most of you will want to address is whether the agreement can survive the temporary bargain and the temporary set of calculations on which it appears to have been made. I'm going to give an optimistic and upbeat answer to that question. So why is it a consociational agreement? First of all, because unlike British parliamentary democracy and Irish parliamentary democracy, it's explicitly conceived in the agreement that there will be a power-sharing executive. Two semi-presidential figures are created in this agreement, a chief minister and a deputy chief minister. They will basically have the ability to be the local heads of state in Northern Ireland. The executive in Northern Ireland will not be a British or Irish parliamentary cabinet. It will not be chosen by the Chief Minister or the Deputy Chief Minister. Instead, parties will get a share of the executive in proportion to their voting strengths. The rule which will decide this is named after the only famous Belgian. You may know the Trivial Pursuit question. which asks you to name a famous Belgian. I'm going to give you the answer to that question. Victor de Hont is the correct Belgian name that you've always been looking for. The de Hont rule will be used to guarantee parties which receive a significant share of the vote a share of seats in the Northern Ireland cabinet, and it will do so automatically. So the Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister will not determine the other ministers in the cabinet. In effect, what will happen is that parties will own ministries. Individual ministers can lose their positions, they can be impeached or voted out of office for breaching their pledge of office, but the party which has that ministry gets to nominate the successor. So it's rather different, a very different model to that which currently prevails in both Britain and Ireland. There will be limited collective responsibility within this power-sharing executive. Ministers will enjoy executive powers under existing legislation, but they will be bound by collective responsibility where they make agreements, and that's an important and complex caveat that people might want to take up. Now, power-sharing executives have existed elsewhere. There are some special features about the agreement. Basically, the Deputy Chief Minister is equally important, just as powerful as the First Minister. The only difference between them is their names. They're both going to preside over the cabinet. They're both going to represent Northern Ireland in external relations. So, in effect, we have a joint, dual semi-presidency. Each bloc, that is to say nationalists and unionists, will be able to veto the other's preferred choice of First Minister or Deputy First Minister. They're going to be elected together. And this is very, very interesting because it will mean that if, for example, Sinn Féin does very well in the elections and surpasses the SDLP in vote share and seat share in the Northern Ireland Assembly, it will mean that unionists will be able to say that we do not want Gerry Adams as the Deputy First Minister. Likewise, nationalists will be able to block an unreasonable or extreme unionist candidate. So there's built into the arrangements incentives to ensure that each bloc puts forward an acceptable candidate to the other bloc, or else there'll be a stalemate. Finally, power sharing is confined to those who support the agreement. If you don't accept the agreement, you cannot, in effect, take the positions in the cabinet that you would otherwise be entitled to. This is a way of ensuring that those who want to wreck the agreement, like the Reverend Ian Paisley and his associated band of followers, won't be able to use these institutions to wreck it, unless one particular scenario occurs, which I'm going to discuss later. So those are the power-sharing executive arrangements. A consociational settlement's also based on the principle of proportionality. In the agreement, it's made clear that in the Northern Ireland Assembly, people will be elected on the basis of proportional representation. We've already seen that the de Hont rule will be used to allocate positions to parties within the executive. But it's not confined, the proportionality principles, to electoral positions. It's clearly envisaged in the agreement that the police force will eventually be made representative of Northern Ireland. The Royal Ulster Constabulary will lose its mono-national status, or there will be multiple police services created within Northern Ireland, depending upon the imagination and wit of Christopher Patton, a subject which no doubt will lead to multiple speculation. The proportionality rules do have some special special features which go against straightforward proportionality. The First Minister and the Deputy First Minister are in effect equals. The system used for electing the Assembly will not be a party list system, which Arent Lipart, the major proponent of consociational theory, argues should be used. Lipart is wrong for reasons that Donald Horowitz, amongst others, has made famous. The party list system may, in fact, create more problems than it solves, in particular because a party list system gives no incentives to voters to moderate their behaviour and to accommodate the other ethnic group or bloc. The voting system to be used in Northern Ireland for the Assembly will be the single transferable vote, And this is where my anorak tendencies come out to complete extent. The single transferable vote enables voters to express preferences in numerical form, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. The advantage of this electoral system is that pro-agreement candidates will be able to argue in front of their voters that they should transfer their votes amongst the pro-agreement candidates and parties. That will mean that nationalists will find it rational to use their lower order preferences to back the supporters of the Ulster Unionist Party who've endorsed the agreement, and that way use their votes strategically against the Reverend Ian Paisley. If that happens for the first time in this Assembly election, and I think it's possible that it might, it will have created the possibility for vote pooling across the nationalist and unionist constituencies, which hitherto has not been very common. Lastly, the agreement envisages proportionality rules in both the public and the private sectors. Northern Ireland already has a vigorous Fair Employment Act by the standards of the rest of Western Europe, and that is going to be improved. The third reason why the settlement is consociational is that it avoids trying to integrate the communities, to make them one. The schooling system will remain the same. Protestants, Catholics, and integrated schools will all receive equal public funding. The respective national languages and respective religions will each get public recognition and public support and protection. In effect, the Irish language will have the same status in Northern Ireland that the Welsh language has in Wales, although it was interesting to hear a Sinn Féin minister accusing the British government of Welshing on this particular promise, which was not a particularly ethnically sensitive remark to make in the circumstances. The big difference in this particular consociational arrangement is that the two governments have deliberately created ways of making Northern Ireland binational. In the Assembly, members will have to register as either nationalist or as unionist or as other. They have no choice. They must define themselves by one of those criteria. That means that the arrangement is explicitly built upon binational principles, or if you prefer, on a three-tier basis. This will create considerable difficulties for the Alliance Party, not least for reasons that I'll explain in a moment when it comes to vital issues on how the Assembly will work. Most importantly, the agreement is based on the equality of both national traditions in Northern Ireland, irrespective of who is the contemporary majority. The last feature of a consociational system is that it gives minorities veto rights. There are multiple veto rights built into this agreement. Within the Assembly, there are two separate ways in which votes can be cast which ensure that minorities have blocking powers. One complex voting method is called the parallel consent procedure. This requires a majority of nationalist members of the Assembly and a majority of unionist members of the Assembly to agree before a proposal is passed. This will govern the budget and possibly other matters. If this rule doesn't work, the Assembly can invoke a second rule, a weighted majority rule. To work, this requires any proposal to have 60% support throughout the Assembly, consisting of at least the support of 40% from each of the nationalist and unionist blocs. Now that gives, in effect, a veto right to 40% of nationalists or 40% of unionists. And remember that figure, because that figure is going to be critical in working out whether this agreement is going to stick and hold. In addition, if any particular grouping of 30 members of the Assembly, there will be 108 members in the Assembly, but if 30 members of the Assembly are unhappy with any proposal, they have the right to petition to ensure that the parallel consent or the weighted majority rules are followed. If they remain unhappy, they can, of course, go to the courts. And unlike the British Constitutional Convention, Northern Ireland is going to have quite vigorous constitutional court provisions. In addition to the European Convention on Human Rights, the British government has promised a tailor-made Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland that will protect collective rights as well as individual rights. In addition, minorities have other mechanisms of protection within the agreement. Most importantly, the agreement embeds what I call a double protection model, as I explained earlier. This basically means the idea that each group is guaranteed the same rights and protections, whether they are a majority or a minority. And importantly, they are guaranteed these rights in the event of a change of sovereignty. So if, in the future, Northern Ireland has majority consent for Irish unification, the British and Protestant minority within a unified Ireland will enjoy exactly the same rights and protections that the Northern nationalist minority is to be given now under the terms of this agreement. If you like, the two governments have engineered something completely novel, a swing constitution, which protects people even if there's a change in the holder of sovereignty. There are other political mechanisms for minorities to get their voices heard. They can appeal to the British and Irish governments, who will retain an intergovernmental conference, and there will be other mechanisms, no doubt, to ensure that they get their voices heard. That's the core of the internal agreement within Northern Ireland. The agreement also has external dimensions, and I'll go through these quickly. The agreement famously sets up two confederal arrangements, one across the whole island of Ireland, the other affecting all the islands and dependent territories of the British Isles and the Irish Isles. The first of these confederations is plainly, at present, the most important and likely to be the most important in the future. A North-South Ministerial Council is to be established. It has a clear confederal character, because Northern Ireland and the Republic will agree to delegate functions and activities to the North-South Ministerial Council, which will then have the capacity to implement those agreed policies on an all-Ireland basis. There's also envisaged a Council of the Isles, or a British-Irish Council. I don't think the people of Jersey or the Isle of Man or other islands were consulted about this at any stage, and they may have something to say about it later. But the Council of the Isles is intended largely as a consultative forum through which there might be agreement on collective policies throughout these islands. It may eventually become an important mechanism for agreeing a common front on policies within the European Union. What these two confederal arrangements do, and they're both envisaged as permanent in some sense, what they do is guarantee that each national community in Northern Ireland will be perpetually linked to their most important national community. If there is a united Ireland, the Council of the Isles will persist, so unionists will remain linked to their co-nationals in Great Britain, even though they're under a separate sovereign. And the North-South Council gives Northern nationalists direct access to their preferred nation state now, even though Irish unification has not taken place. The agreement also has fascinating federal components. Within the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland has always had the right of secession and no right of independence, and that's been preserved. But what's intriguing from the perspective of international law is that the UK has recognised the Irish people's right to national self-determination. It is my understanding, though fortunately I'm not a lawyer, that that means in international law that Britain would be in breach of a treaty if it were to use the power of Westminster in any way that breached the agreement. And if the minimum condition of a federation is that neither of two tiers of government can unilaterally alter the constitutional relationship, I would argue that in international law terms, the relationship between Westminster and Northern Ireland has become federal, although I'm sure there'll be plenty of people to tell me that that's an erroneous argument. I would expect over time the UK courts to treat Northern Ireland cases rather like the way they treated Dominion cases in the past. Internally, we know that the UK is developing what looks like political federalism, even though it retains the Dicean notion of Westminster's sovereignty remaining paramount and absolute. And that, of course, is the domestic view of the UK state. But from an international law point of view, I think the relationship between Northern Ireland and the UK is becoming federal. What is fascinating, if you read the text of the agreement carefully, is that the UK state places no limitations on the autonomy that Northern Ireland might wish to give itself by consent. In other words, if within the Assembly and within the Executive in Northern Ireland there's an agreement to take more and more power and responsibility within Northern Ireland in functions not devolved under this agreement, then the Secretary of State and the Westminster Parliament leave themselves open to approve all of those changes. So in effect, the UK state is saying, you can have as much autonomy as you like, pending eventual Irish unification. There's no constraint on expanding the level of autonomy. So the agreement decisively signals the end of unitary unionism within the United Kingdom, at least as regards relationships between Britain and Northern Ireland, and of course, as long as the agreement holds. The agreement also has federalising implications for the Republic of Ireland. Not only does the Republic think of the North-South Ministerial Council as a first step towards a federation, the changes in the Republic's constitutional provisions in effect mean, I think, that the Republic is obligated to protect diversity throughout the island of Ireland in the event of unification, which makes it more likely that if there is any unification at a future point, that it will take a federal form, and it won't take the form of simply absorbing Northern Ireland into the Republic in the way that old-fashioned Republicans who insist on a 32-county sovereign Ireland would want. In effect, the Republic of Ireland has been in the position of the characters in Waiting for Godot, waiting for something that never comes. It was interesting, of course, that Waiting for Godot was written by an Ulster Protestant who lived in the Republic of Ireland. But in effect, Godot may come now because of this agreement and demographic change, and the agreement requires the Republic to prepare itself for that eventuality. The double protection model obviously suggests that, and the Republic's management of its European public policy through the North-South Ministerial Council may well mean that the Republic develops federal habits with its northern partners in preparing all-Ireland public policy. Okay, that's the core of my textual analysis of the agreement. What's it based on? The agreement's based on a very hard-headed calculation. It's based on a hard-headed calculation by the nationalist population that they get equality now out of this agreement with the possibility of unity later. Republicans have basically made a cost-benefit calculation. They know that they're not going to get anything more out of their long war, and they can get as much out of a long march through these new institutions as they could expect to get from their long war. Evidence of this is pretty plain, at least to my eyes, over the last few years, but if you look at the actual detailed negotiations that took place, particularly in the last days in Belfast, Sinn Féin did not concentrate on North-South institutions. It paid almost no attention to them. It focused its attention primarily on achieving equality within Northern Ireland for the nationalist community. On the unionist side, I've read a tremendous amount of inaccurate information. I'm told that unionists signed because of the charms of Tony Blair. Unionists signed because of the avuncular diplomatic skills of Senator George Mitchell. Unionists signed because they wanted the IRA's war to end. All of this is deeply insulting to the intelligence of David Trimble and other unionists. They signed the agreement not for those reasons, though they may have been important as background variables. They signed the agreement because it's their calculation that the agreement safeguards the union. Their view is that if they didn't make this agreement, something worse might happen in the future. The Irish state and the British state may have built another agreement, like the Anglo-Irish agreement, over their heads. They made this agreement now because they calculate that if they make the decision to reform Northern Ireland and treat nationalists equally, that's their best chance of reconciling nationalists to the continuation of the Union. Obviously, their calculation differs from the Paisleyites. The Unionists in the negotiations focused on weakening those aspects of the proposals which would create difficulty for them with the Democratic Unionist Party and other hardline Unionists. So they did focus their attention on weakening the proposed North-South arrangements. So you might want to say, well, if the agreement is based on widely different perceptions about the long run, how can it possibly hold? Well, there are reasons for being cheerful. Both blocs have very good reasons to believe they're right, but they can't be certain that they're right. Nationalists know that demographically they're growing. They know that the British state has no enthusiasm for maintaining its relationship with Ulster Unionists. They see these institutional arrangements as creating possibilities for federalising or unifying Ireland. Unionists also have reasonable grounds for their beliefs. They can think correctly that if nationalists are well governed and share in self-government and are treated equally, that they can persuade them of the benefits of retaining the British connection. So both have good reasons to believe they're right, and we don't know as yet when either of them is going to be proven correct. So it may not be a terrible beauty, the fact that they have rival perceptions of the future. But perhaps most importantly, and here's my confidence-building measure, the double protection model means that whoever is wrong in the future will have their pain eased. The agreement has a built-in neuralgic. If Unionists discover they're wrong, at least their position within the Republic of Ireland will be much better than it would otherwise have been. If Nationalists do not get Irish unity, at least they have accomplished significant autonomy, equality, and linkages to their preferred nation-state. And the complex political arrangements within Northern Ireland create incentives for each bloc to behave well towards the other bloc to make their preferred long-term future a self-fulfilling prophecy. Okay, I'm going to skip over short-run difficulties except to focus on one particular question. The referendum. I've been assuming the referendum is going to be passed. I'm very happy to bet that I'm going to be correct on that. What's the critical figure you should look at to see whether the agreement is going to hold after a yes vote in the referendum in the north? My answer is 64%. Why? Nationalists are going to overwhelmingly endorse this agreement, approximately 40% of the population of the north. To work, the institutions of the agreement require the support of 40% of all non-nationalists. 40% of 60% is 24%, so to speak. Add the 40 to the 24, you get 64. So if the yes vote is significantly below 64, get worried. If it's 64 and above, the institutions are robust enough to survive the level of opposition to the agreement. Let me give you some predictions about what will happen in seats in the Assembly. I'm predicting that the minimum Unionist seat share will be 55, maximum 62, Nationalist minimum 39, maximum 45, others a range of variation between 5 and 11. I think the most likely outcome of an election will be Unionists getting 56 seats, Nationalists 44, and others 8. Now, the only thing that really matters in the first few months of the agreement will be that other bloc if the level of Unionist support for the agreement isn't strong. The Alliance Party has to choose whether to define itself as Unionist or other. If there are not enough Unionist Party members who support the agreement in the Assembly when it convenes, then the Alliance Party will have to behave strategically. It will have to declare itself to be a Unionist Party in order to increase the share of moderate Unionists within the Assembly in order to make it work. They are terribly cross-pressured on this question, but it might mean that they have a critical bridge-building role to play. Okay, I have taken up a considerable proportion of time. I think I'll stop indulging myself there and leave myself open to interrogation. Thank you.
Before I ask Professor Halliday to respond, perhaps I should point out that there are plenty of seats in this corner for those who don't have them yet.
Hope to talk for about 10 minutes. I'm not...
The floor is yours.
Good. Brendan, actually, can I get... Yes, this, can I get slightly... Not going to respond to Brendan so much as touch on another aspect of this question, which is, broadly speaking, the international dimension. I would like, however, to begin on a personal note. I think for anybody who's born in Ireland or brought up there, this agreement does mark a very significant and historic opportunity. It's a thing which I think means a lot to us, not just as students of politics, but also as people who throughout our lives have lived with this problem, a problem which in one way or another has been going on, as I reminded an Arab audience recently, since the days of Saladin and the Abbasid Empire, since the 12th century. I was brought up in a town which was then and still is the headquarters of the IRA, a town called Dundalk, which is about 4 miles from the border. Ian Paisley always refers to it as Gundalk or El Paso. Brought up in a relatively tranquil time in the 40s and 50s, but the unresolved issue of the Southern Irish Civil War, in which, interestingly, about the same number of people died by most calculations as have died in the recent conflict, sort of 3,000 to 4,000, was very much there. And many people in the town were indeed from the IRA. And my father's view, he had a business there, was that in order not to get into trouble, he should employ them. The result was that not only our gardeners, but all our babysitters were from the IRA. My babysitters were from that organization. So was his secretary, who had a wooden leg. She was also the treasurer of the IRA, and she kept the funds in her leg. And I think there was a sense in retrospect, which will be familiar to all of us, that the agreement of the 1920s at some point couldn't last. It wouldn't stick. It didn't have sufficient legitimacy in the South or in the North. And of course, the first shots in that delegitimation, the new round of delegitimation, were something that I remember very well indeed, which was the bombing campaign of 56 to 62, which was launched from the town in which I lived. And I think all that has followed, those of you who've lived there more recently than I have, although I've visited frequently, will be aware of the terrible tragedy and indeed shame of what this conflict has meant for Ireland, and therefore the possibilities, the possibility that this agreement will actually mean something. I want to look at this agreement in an international context and in several ways. First of all, I think in all conflicts that take a nationalist form, there is a presumption of uniqueness. We're different from other people, and we're not affected by what goes on abroad. And if you look at the literature in Ireland, the journalistic literature, or the biographical literature, or the political literature, it's always assumed there's something different about Ireland. It's not like other places. It's not going to be affected by, and it is not in many ways comparable with other places. Remember in the early 70s, in 1971, I was interviewing the then head of the IRA, Rory O'Brady. And I said to him, this was the time of world student upheaval and all these things, I said, have international political influences and struggles had any influence on the IRA? And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Halliday, he said, in Ireland, we have no need of your Che Guevara's and your Ho Chi Minh's. And then he gave a long list from Wolfe Tone and others, Cathal Brewer and others, who had conducted struggle throughout all these years. And yet, if you look at the history of both nationalisms in Ireland, and I treat unionism as a form of nationalism, a form of communal identity, both their ideology and the context in which they developed have been shaped and continue to be shaped by international factors. The rise of Catholic nationalism in Ireland in the 19th century really borrowed the main themes of Mazzinian and Carlylean nationalism. Very simple examples, the tricolour is just a standard, you know, liberal model. I mean, Italians have it and all sorts of other people have it, so Ireland had it too. The very slogan, Sinn Féin, meaning ourselves alone, of course, is the slogan of Friedrich List and of every other nationalist in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And you can see time and again the invocation by various strands of Catholic nationalism of what others are doing. Now, in the late 60s, it took the form very often of invoking the struggles of Vietnam, Palestine, Cuba, and the rest of it. More recently, of course, you will notice a subtext in the writings and speeches of the Honourable Member for West Belfast, comparing himself slightly to Mandela, and if not to Mandela, then to somebody who, like Mandela, had finally delivered his people after a long struggle. So I think in the minds of the elite and in the slogans, there are many such international references. And of course, on the other side too. I mean, Paisley's whole formation is in Scottish and American Presbyterianism, and he was educated in the United States, and he has borrowed extensively from that. The reason I say this is because I think it challenges, this goes to the argument on nationalism, both the kind of idea of traditions or rhetorics as being fixed, but also the idea of traditions and rhetorics as being constituted by the nation they're in. In other words, you borrow from abroad, you borrow from abroad also to change. And the hope I would express is that in a changed international context and in a changed situation within Ireland, as you have, the definition of what is unionism or republicanism or Irish nationalism will itself subtly change. And indeed, it is. Two obvious historical points. On the unionist side, unionism until 1920 was unionism for the whole of Ireland. If you told Carson or Craig in 1912 that Ireland would be partitioned, they'd have been as against it as any Catholic nationalist. And yet, in the end, they had to accept it. And some of Trimble's recent statements about the multicultural character of Britain, and as a descendant of the original inhabitants of these islands, I would point out the Anglo-Saxons are illegal immigrants. Welcome now, but they are. The island has always been multicultural. I think Trimble's own espousal of that is an interesting example of an attempt to redefine that tradition. And on the nationalist side, whatever else Adams and his friends envisage, Sinn Féin isn't it. I mean, if you're living off Brussels grants or hoping to be integrated in Europe, this is not Sinn Féin and will not be. And one hopes that in other dimensions too, while these two communal identities will remain, they will also change and in response to international ideological context. And I think the comparison of Adams with Mandela is preposterous, but if imagining himself as Mandela or if presenting himself to his own people as Mandela enables him to sell it to his own followers, which is what he's been trying to do this past decade or more, then fine, let him do it. And the same for whatever Trimble gets up to. But there are other senses in which the international matters. I mean, you can't write the history of Ireland without the Reformation or the French Revolution or the First World War. The Bolshevik Revolution rather passed Ireland by, but that be that as it may. Stalin once said the IRA talked too much. That was their problem. I once met... No, I digress. I won't go on about that. Let me say in what ways I think the international has actually helped bring us to this point. I think one could overstate it because every conflict has certain unique features, but I think it would be a mistake to ignore it. There are four obvious ways in which international change has helped to bring about this agreement and may help to provide a context for this agreement to work. Now, I'm putting it in cautious terms because we must all remember, and we do remember, Machiavelli's first advice: do not mistake your wishes for reality. First is the European Union. The European Union obviously has made an immense difference to the South. The South today is, thank heavens, not the South I grew up in. It's a very different society. It's a much more open society, a much more confident society, not least in economic terms. And there's also a South which itself, as Brendan was pointing out, with regard to federalism, even within the South or within the United Ireland, has learned from the constitutional developments in other countries. The South has its own interesting political traditions. It gave women the vote before Great Britain did. It had proportional representation before Britain did. If I may say so, it also was a republic before Britain were to become so. So it has shown its own political vanguardism, if you like, or novelty. But that having been said, the opening to Europe in economic terms, in cultural terms, has made an immense difference, as it has for even the unionist community in the North, who have found that they have a voice in Brussels, and they can go to Brussels and talk to people in a way that circumvents Westminster as well as circumventing Dublin. And it was Martin Walker, the Guardian correspondent, who said, you know, if Sinn Féin people and unionists come to Brussels, they go around on the same bus together, they chat to each other, they know each other, they're not engaging in sectarian politics when it gets to Brussels. I think the European Union's had another effect, and that's on the British elite. One of the silent dogs that doesn't bark very often is anti-Catholic prejudice in the British establishment. It's still there to some extent. Some of you may remember the effusions of one of the less distinguished alumni of LSE, Mr. Kilroy Silk, a couple of years ago, about how the Irish were still clerical and all the rest of it. But the fact that even Thatcher, surprisingly, was not didn't have this. In fact, if anything, the agreement of 85 that she reached was probably unduly unfavorable to the unionists. But the disappearance of that anti-Catholic prejudice, which a generation ago, and when I was sent to school in this country in the 50s, was still very strong, and partly a legacy of the Second World War, and the sense that Catholics were traitors and pro-Vatican and all that, that has also been a product of the European integration and a permissive condition, I think, of some of the change we've seen. Second factor, which I wouldn't overstate or understate, is the end of the Cold War. Mick Cox at Aberystwyth, who worked in Belfast for 20 years and was a tutor in the Mays prison, among other places, and who knows that society very well, he's written on this. But I think it should be said, I mean, first of all, any strategic argument that Britain needs to keep Northern Ireland for reasons of Atlantic security and submarine warfare, that's gone. On the conversely, the idea that the Northern Ireland conflict was part of some worldwide anti-imperialist movement, which was common in the 60s and early 70s, that again has very little meaning. The prestige of guerrillas in the world today is not what it was in the late 60s or early 70s. But I think something else, and here's my third point, which is the impact of other peace agreements. I mean, it's common for people to say the 1990s is an epoch of anarchy and chaos and ethno-nationalism and all the rest of it. But a lot of agreements have been reached in the late 80s and 1990s in different parts of the world, some of which have stuck, Namibia, Central America, some of which are working in a sort of way. Cambodia hasn't gone back to where it was. The Arab-Israeli conflict has not gone back to where it was. South Africa has not gone back to where it was. And in that sense, there is a momentum of diplomatic involvement, but also a momentum of demonstration effect with a small d and a small e, which I think has affected some of those directly involved in Ireland, but also some of those involved in the negotiating procedure. And there are elements in this agreement and the negotiation procedure which echo things that have happened elsewhere, whether it is in the way in which contacts were established or maximal expectations were lowered. And I think that while there is no one-to-one correlation, I think that sense of Irish exceptionalism, you know, we're going to go on killing each other, whatever else, all these other people may stop fighting, that is somewhat less and has helped. And I certainly think that if you look at the way in which the South African settlement has been used in Ireland, I think that has had a somewhat positive effect. And fourthly, there is the US role. Now, the US role is not just to talk to Adams, it's also been to talk to Trimble. It's also been to give them both a voice, to give them a say in US policy, to keep the door open. Brendan knows much more about this than I, but the US has been engaged as a facilitator. There are nationalists, Irish nationalists in America, who don't support violence, but who are willing to back a peace agreement with money and with support. There is a whole hidden story there which has played an important and positive role. And I think that the evolution of the Irish community in America is important. I mean, the kind of simplistic, you know, green beer St. Paddy's Day nationalism which prevailed in the States has receded. I remember going to a bar in Boston 20 years ago and being offered a nail bomb special as the kind of local cocktail that they particularly recommended. And I think the change in that attitude and the more subtle engagement of the United States is important. Three final points, really. One is, to repeat Machiavelli, let's not mistake our wishes for reality. There's a lot that can go wrong in the middle and longer run. And if they want to quarrel and fall out, they could fall out over anything, the color of a street sign or the cover of a school textbook or anything else. I've acquired in life a unionist mother-in-law, and she has one of her sayings, which Paisley also repeats endlessly, is, "Come into my parlor," said the spider to the fly. And that is very much her view of this agreement. And I think there are many others, egged on by the Daily Mail and others in this country, who hold this view. I fear that if there is a substantial no vote or abstention in the South on the question of revising the Constitution, this will also play back into the North. So I don't think we're home and dry by a long way. And I would reinforce this by emphasizing something which everybody from Ireland knows, but if you don't, not from Ireland, you may not know, is the degree of separation between the two communities, particularly in the North. Only 1% of primary and secondary education in the North is integrated. In other words, and the separation and the lack of knowledge of other communities is reinforced in this agreement. The great magic phrase is parity of esteem, and much talk of community and all that, but there is a downside to it. There is a fossilization, there is an institutionalization of separation. If you want to study that kind of thing, go to Derry and just stand on the walls of Derry and see what in effect is a kind of physical separation of Catholics and Protestants, which has meant peace in the main, but has also meant a breaking down of even minimal social links between the communities. I was in Belfast in December. I said, I'm all for parity of esteem, but there's also parity of paranoia, parity of blither, parity of nonsense. And I think this agreement may, to some extent, reinforce that. And finally, of course, all these international agreement pressures and involvements are fine for the elite who are going to Washington or Brussels and aware of these precedents. I'm not sure how far they've percolated down. I hope to some extent they do. Thank you.
Professor Farr.
I shall be very brief because I also think it's important that the chairman is able to make remarks as well too. I don't have any specialist information or knowledge about the current arrangements. I just want to make one or two observations. I mean, my father was born in Kells in County Meath, and he was what in those days was called a West Briton, and so he had a British passport. And Ireland, it was the unionist sort of tradition that was referred to by Fred Halliday. It was what founder of this institution here called John Bull's Other Ireland. And my mother was an Ulster Scot, and I've gone to university both at Queen's University in Belfast and Trinity College in Dublin. I think my main concern is to whether the right lessons have been learned from failure in the past and what the cost of that failure has been. And I'm referring here really to 1920 and to partition as a solution to a problem, because it isn't a uniquely Irish affair. But dividing up the historic province of Ulster, those were 9 counties, so you redraw the boundary inside that and you make it 6 counties. And that's because Monaghan, Cavan and Donegal were 95 or more percent Catholic. One of the consequences of that is you create a very small area, which is not good for parliamentary democracy if you give home rule to such a reduced community. And I think that that's one of the problems. And this postponed regional government in these islands for a very long time because the quality of politicians was such that this was had to be suspended. But I am very influenced by Brendan O'Leary's analysis of the present arrangements, and I do think from listening to his more upbeat evaluation of it that maybe we have learned some of the right lessons from the failure of the previous Stormont Assembly, and that there are more built-in guarantees here that might make it work. And there's one area where I think progress has been made, and I hope that this optimistic appraisal works. I think there's another consequences too, and that is that there wasn't, if you like, an adequate separation between church and state in the south. And there were politicians, Conor Cruise O'Brien, for example, and Garrett Fitzgerald, who would have welcomed the disappearance of the border because a significant proportion of Protestants would have resulted in a more secular state. And many Irish people would have welcomed that, and I think that that got postponed as well as a result of that original partition as a solution. And it certainly isn't a unique Irish affair, because the British took, and I'm talking really about the wider British responsibility in partitioning Ireland originally, that they took the same defective plan out of the Whitehall drawer when they created the State of Israel. And again, you create a boundary, a partition, and you put people of one religion on one side and one on the other. Repeated it again in withdrawing from empire in India, and you create the difference between India and Pakistan. So it's a solution that was flawed, and not flawed just because of the Irish situation, but it's flawed when you repeat it in other contexts around the world as well. And the same would apply to Cyprus. So I think that that isn't, there's a lesson to be learned from that. And I can, if I reminisce just very briefly, I was a schoolboy and I recall the Reverend Ian Paisley being had up for disturbance of the peace in terms of what he was saying, and even serving some prison for disturbing the peace. This is a very, very long time ago. And that was because, and he was an eccentric, but he saw in a very paranoid way that there were things going on beyond the north of Ireland that would undermine the peculiar position of the north of Ireland. And in this sense, he was perfectly correct. This was the ecumenical movement, which would remove the difference between the Catholic Church and other churches, and also going into Europe, because you'd have a Protestant minority within Catholic Europe. So he was consistently against these things, and he effectively managed to derail that happening. So in that sense, because he consistently kept saying the same thing, he then acquired a following which had a disastrous effect and unseated two, quote, liberal, unquote, prime ministers as a result of that. And that greatly postponed the European Union working itself out in Ireland, because a border between two member states is ridiculous. And it would have worked itself out in the ways that one hopes these new cross-border institutions will work in the future. What is hopeful is that there are new structures now that aren't yet tested, these wider federal and confederal structures, which might work within a European context in solving other European issues of conflict at a regional level. But we shouldn't assume that the structural failures from the past, I think we need to learn more about them. And a peacemaker in the present situation might seem to be a peacemaker elsewhere, but that's because of the same structural flaws in Israel and in India and Pakistan. But I'd like to leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, all three of you. And we're going to open this up in just a moment to the floor for questions or discussion. We said that we would break at 2, and I'll take about 2 or 3 minutes of the 5 minutes before 2 to say a word or two, and then we can have from 2 to 2:30 to carry on with the conversation for those who are able to do so. People have been declaring their childhood roots here, and I suppose I should say that I too was born in a western outpost of Ireland, and I mean the island. I mean, of course, Manhattan Island, which at least in my neighborhood certainly was a western outpost of Ireland, I can smell the Guinness right now. I want to say that there's a not on you. It's in my mind's eye. There's a lot to like in this agreement. There's a lot to be skeptical of, too. In a certain sense, it would be useful to lay out a completely pessimistic case for this, so that we could really join issue and have a very good debate here. But unfortunately, this is not the there isn't enough time to do that. So I'm just going to restrict myself to about 3 points. I like the blurring of sovereignty that's part of this agreement. I like the East-West and the North-South bits of it, because ethnically divided societies tend to fight over who's going to control the state. And to the extent that the state becomes a little bit obscure, to the extent that Stormont isn't the be-all and end-all, well, to that extent, there's some prospect for a reduction of the ferocity of the competition to control the political institutions that are supposed to govern. So, without having gone carefully to the details of the North, South, and East, West arrangements, and in fact, without having gone in carefully to the details of the entire agreement, I've just read it cursorily and read some commentaries on it. I think that that's a useful contribution, and it may actually play a role different from the role that the proponents of the councils think that it's going to play. It'll make things a lot more complex, and this is not always a bad thing in these conflicts. It's the simplicity of the confrontation, the sheer opposition of the contending parties, that's often part of the problem. Now, let me make a skeptical remark about the objectives, the statement of objectives in the agreement. and one way to get into this is simply to seize on the phrase parity of esteem, which also translates elsewhere in the agreement to equality. Don't get me wrong, I'm in favor of parity of esteem, and I'm in favor of equality. But what I know about severely divided societies is twofold. First, that this is the very question over which the struggles are about. It's the core of the issue always. Whose state is this? Who's going to control this? Who's going to be primus inter pares? Who's going to have an edge over the other group? Who's going to be fearful that the other group is going to get an edge over us? When you promise, therefore, parity of esteem up front, rather than as the result of a political process, you've made a quite maximal commitment. And you may very well, in a divided society, have set yourself up for a lot of disappointment, for shortfalls in delivery. I can imagine 5 years from now somebody saying, well, parity of esteem is what they promised us, and look at what we've got. We've only got 60% of parity of esteem, or 72% of parity of esteem. When you set yourself up for the non-delivery of goods in this way, you may very well cause a great deal of disappointment and perpetuate the conflict that you're trying to resolve. Having said that, I want to say that if you want to set yourself up for maximal progress early on, and I do want to underscore that most severely divided societies are going to creep along rather than leap along in the progress they make in ethnic relations. If you're going to do this, it seems to me what you need is a strong base of electoral support. That is, you're going to need to shore up the moderates on both sides, because it's going to require quite a lot of reciprocal concessions to get this thing accomplished. And therefore, you need an electoral system that's going to advantage the people who are willing to compromise. Now, it's quite true that the single transferable vote is better than list system PR in this respect, because list system PR with ethnically based parties of the sort you have in Northern Ireland simply sets up a zero-sum competition between lists and therefore a zero-sum competition between ethnically based parties with no possibility of transferring votes across from one ethnically based list to another. Single transferable vote provides that possibility. But alas, it's quite easy to get elected to a seat under a single transferable vote system because it's easy to make your quota. I won't bore you with the formula. But suffice it to say that in a constituency with 4 seats, a candidate who gets 1/5 of the vote plus one will be deemed elected. That means it's very easy to get elected on the votes of your own community. And in 1973, in the Northern Ireland elections, based on the single transferable vote, we know that there were very few transfers of preferences across community lines. In my view, well, let me say, it may be different this time. There may be some transfers. It may be that the middle will feel sufficiently embattled, depending on how the configuration breaks out, sufficiently embattled between Sinn Féin on the one hand and the Paisleyites on the other, it may be that they'll be able to make these arrangements. If so, that will be a very good and lucky thing. There are other systems, I think, the electoral systems, I think, that could have shored up these incentives in a stronger way. But on the whole, I think what one wants to say is the stronger the incentives to moderation, to bolstering the forces that are willing to make compromises and willing to exchange second preferences and third preferences across the community lines, the better you're going to be. And actually, on the whole, the fewer the major promises you make at the outset, going in other words, the better off you're going to be. And here, I'm concerned about the combination. Maximalist promises and only moderate ability to shore them up electorally. And this strikes me as potentially dangerous. The other point I want to make relates to the declaration of members' affinities. That is, members are to declare themselves to be unionist, nationalist, or other. And of course, if the Alliance Party, which is the only multi-ethnic party in Northern Ireland, which as historically polls around 10% of the vote. Not much, never much less, never much more. But it's a hopeful sign. A multi-ethnic party that persisted in a severely divided society over a long time is a generally hopeful sign. Most severely divided societies can't keep this up, even at the 10% level. If that party is forced to declare itself to be a unionist party for the strategic reasons that have been outlined here, it will undoubtedly lose some Catholic support, which is, even if it explains itself fully and explains the rationale for this declaration fully. In addition to that, the fact that others have to declare themselves would seem to lock the parties into their status as representatives of one community rather than another in a way that you might think is merely realistic, but on the other hand, you might think is a little bit unhealthy for a polity that's trying to overcome these precise divisions. Liepart, incidentally, the proponent of consociational democracy, doesn't suggest this at all. He says, let the parties organize as they will. If they're ethnically based parties, that's fine. Don't require any of them to declare what they are. Let them just behave according to their instincts and according to the support they wish to cultivate. We'll know what they are. Their supporters will know what they are, and so will their opponents. And I think in this respect, I'm with Liepart. I think that this was an unfortunate turn, and I think the arrangements could have been set up in such a way that this would have been unnecessary. Now, underlying this objection, I should say, are some background developments that have gone insufficiently noticed in Northern Ireland. I've been in recent months digging out sample surveys of opinion of ethnic opinion in Northern Ireland. That is, question: would you like to have more contact, less contact, or the same contact with people on the other side? Answer: overwhelmingly, more. Question: what do you think of those people on the other side? What are they like? Oh, well, they're ordinary people just like us. Now, I want to tell you that I've studied societies like Northern Ireland all around the world, and these are not typical answers. The typical answers you would get would go in the opposite direction. I don't really care to have any more contact with those people. I'd rather they went away. Are they ordinary people just like us? No. On the contrary, they're too, altogether too powerful, unscrupulous, scheming, cunning, industrious. They work too hard. They work harder than we want to work. They're going to kill us in competition. Or on the other side, they're lazy, no good, passive, traditional, insufficiently motivated, unenterprising people, and frankly not worthy of our attention. So the survey results in Northern Ireland that you're beginning to see are really quite different. They suggest something very important is happening under the surface. And if you look at rates of intermarriage, you will see also that the same sorts of things are happening. Because rates of intermarriage have been climbing from, to be sure, a very low base in recent decades. And in Belfast, I wish I could remember the starting and ending points of these. I think maybe it's 79 to 90, something like that. Intermarriage doubled in Belfast from 6 to 11% of all marriages across community lines. Again, when you start getting into double digits in exogamy, you're talking about a society that's beginning to move out of its compartments. And that's another reason for thinking that it's a bit unfortunate that the declaration has to be made in the way that it is. These underlying developments are also background factors, of course, that would give you a good bit of optimism that with a little bit of goodwill, a little bit of pushing, a little bit of confidence building, that these arrangements can be made to work. Whereas if you thought that the trends were going in the opposite direction, you'd say, well, no arrangements like this, especially no complicated arrangements like this, could possibly be made to work. They couldn't be made to work today in Sri Lanka, for example, under the circumstances. You'd have to have something quite different in Sri Lanka, sort of community-based devolution, where people got away from each other before they got back together. These arrangements are a combination of we'll do our own thing and we'll do our thing together. And it's just barely possible that they may survive even some of what I take to be some of the unfortunate features of their design. Thank you. Let's take a minute for those who wish to, who need to get up and go someplace. and then we'll carry on until 2:30. As I said earlier, I need to leave at 2:20 myself.
That's very interesting. There's a pledge of office. There's an attempt to counteract the "I'm just a representative." I think they got the Ashton's news from other out of the voting rules.
Congratulations on using this. I don't think I've ever seen anyone in LSE ever do that before. So
thank you very much.
Is that PowerPoint?
Yes.
That's nice. The equality, I think the SDLP dreamed up those rules.
That you declare yourself to run
in order to get the voting rules to work.
Why couldn't they just do it by party? I don't understand it. They didn't have to have majority. They could just have super majority thresholds by party.
They could have. I mean, there are other mechanisms, but that's how they chose to do it. I think the big difference between this problem and the analysis, and I think the electoral arrangements have put a lot of shenanigans in the world, and that makes it easy for members. If they had the alternative vote tomorrow, they're basically telling the shenanigans they get their share of the action. They're learning and gaining from being that now.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, very telling point, and I think that's exactly where the issue could be joined. You want to say, what are the costs and benefits of pushing hard against the extremes as against pulling to the center? In the end, I can't help, I don't know of any
deciding
of
deciding which extremes you want to marginalize.
That too. I can't, although, in the end, you have to marginalize. If you're going to go for the middle, you have to marginalize them both. Because each one, every time there's a compromise, it's reciprocated. Both sides will be against both extremes.
Well,
okay,
Go ahead,
leave when I need to.
It's a pleasure to see such interest. Would anybody like to raise a question about anything any of the speakers have said, or would they like to make a comment of their own? I see a hand here, then here, then here, then here. I'm sorry, he went to school in Fermanagh, and that's
no,
the
base. Sure.
Correction accepted. And if I may comment briefly on decommissioning, it wasn't because of my anorak tendency that I left it out. I deliberately left it out because I don't think it's as big an issue as you imagine. There is a program in the agreement which requires decommissioning to take place within 2 years. But no decommissioning is required in advance of the meeting of the Assembly. This will give Sinn Féin an opportunity if it wishes to take its seats, but Sinn Féin, like the Loyalist parties, is bound by the Mitchell Principles. It's bound by the Mitchell Principles and a pledge of office, and those are legally actionable in the courts. So if Sinn Féin and the Loyalist parties make no effort to accomplish some decommissioning, or fail to distance themselves from any paramilitary activity, it will be available to parties to take appropriate court actions. We wouldn't have had this agreement had there not been a decision to avoid the impasse that could have been created by decommissioning. I also take the view that people will
at least if there's sufficient support for the agreement within the unionist camp, take a robust attitude towards decommissioning. And the private armies will slowly disappear. From a strategic and realist point of view, it's better that those armies slowly disorganize themselves rather than be required to engage in a rapid surrender now. In those circumstances, the dissidents who oppose the agreement would be able to take away much of the resource capacity of those organizations. Do come back later. Yes, I think you're next, then here. And sorry, I've forgotten who. Did I take somebody from over there? Here and here. Go first.
Given sort of question, concerns you on Mara's side on the question of identity regulation, what is the rationale behind that? Because his concerns are actually pretty reasonable, and as far as I can see, there's nothing in the agreement that's even mentioned that this being a natural part of it. So what is the rationale behind
I think the explanation for why we have the official declaration of identity comes from the SDLP's desire to have cross-community consent rules built into the agreement. This is not the only way it could have been done. It's the way they've chosen to do it. If you were being extremely cynical and Machiavellian, you would assume that it was done in order to screw the Alliance Party. I don't think it was intended to do that. I think it was just a byproduct of working out cross-community consent rules. There is a feature of the agreement which partly softens the impact of the declaration. Any minister has to take a pledge of office, not an oath of allegiance, and that pledge of office includes strong requirements to serve all the people equally. And that pledge of office is binding not only on the minister, but by the doctrine of ministerial responsibility on the entirety of the relevant department. So it does not become possible for people to choose to make ministries, so to speak, into ethnic enclaves, so that education becomes a nationalist precinct and tourism becomes a unionist precinct. The requirement to serve everybody equally creates a certain limitation with legal meaning on the activities of possible ministers. I think it would have been possible to have generated weighted majority rules without requiring explicit registration of people as nationalist, unionist, or other. Yes?
My question has to do with the educational provision. As you pointed out, education for thousands of integrated schools will remain as is, that is, separate but equal. But in fact, secondly, is one to infer from this that in neither the Protestant nor Roman Catholic communities is there a sufficient body of opinion convinced that over time it is essential to move toward integration in the educational system?
The first thing I'd like to just carefully emphasize is that the system as is very, very recent. There wasn't equal funding for each system up until as late as 1992. There was a brief attempt to bias funding on the part of the British government in favor of integrated education, but they didn't find that they had great take-up. The percentage of those indicating a willingness to engage in integrated education is much higher than those who take advantage of the actual opportunities. And that's one area in which I'd probably be more skeptical than Don about Northern Ireland opinion poll survey responses. The population of Northern Ireland has become extremely skilled at avoiding accusations of bigotry. Both Protestants and Catholics know how to present themselves as reasonable and unbigoted, and they do so with magnificent effect in surveys which do not correspond to their voting conduct or to their private conversations. If they decode you wrongly, they will often make remarks which indicate that their real views are strongly antagonistic. Integration is largely pursued and favoured by the South Belfast educated graduate class. Elsewhere in Northern Ireland, particularly in Western Northern Ireland, there's very limited demand for integrated education. One of the problems of demographic shift in Northern Ireland is that a Protestant stroke state school closes down. The school isn't used for a while. Then an application is made to use the school by Catholics, and the school is reopened as a Catholic school. Those wanting an integrated school don't have the numbers to generate the public funding that would otherwise exist for them to go for the building of an integrated school. So education is only integrated at the higher level, at university level, and even then, amongst the student bodies, it's arguable that it doesn't take place to the extent that one would expect in terms of dormitory allocations, halls of residence, and so on. Fred, you wanted to say something on this?
No, as I understand it, you would have social relations between young Catholics and Protestants. But if you get married, you can't live in a working class area. You've got to live in a middle class area, that's not a class. But then you come to what is the key issue. It's the issue of my personal life, is the rest of education. Are the kids going to be working as Catholics or Protestants? And at that point, there is no good law for a school. And that's the loop. As far as universities are concerned, the problem is that the Protestant middle class is increasingly sending their kids to be educated outside of the island. Queens is now around the quite a nice Catholic university.
In student body, but not in staff. It's a very, very good question. The agreement has built into it a series of tripwires and safeguards. They don't cover ultimate failure, but some of them are there. The Republic's constitutional change only becomes operative if the agreement to establish the Assembly and the North-South Ministerial Council materializes. So the Republic's constitutional change is contingent upon the emergence of the institutions promised in the agreement. Those institutional aspects of the agreement that set up the Assembly and the North-South Ministerial Council are interdependent. Once there's an Assembly, the Assembly must complete a body of work to create North-South functional cooperation in a range of matters. If that doesn't happen, then neither the Assembly comes into being nor the North-South Ministerial Council. They're mutually interdependent. So, at least at the outset, the content of the bargain is dependent upon everybody fulfilling their obligations. Once the agreement's institutions are in place, the question is, will they then be derailed? Will they then break down? And what happens if they do break down? In my view, if they break down very quickly, what happens is you, in effect, have a continuation of the Anglo-Irish agreement. The British government would, for the time being, abandon any prospect of trying to create an agreed devolved government, but would, in order to sustain the ceasefires, continue with its program of release of paramilitary prisoners belonging to organizations which have ceasefires, move rapidly on those issues connected with equality and parity of esteem that do not require the active participation of local politicians in order for them to be realized. And they would also move ahead on functional cross-border cooperation with the Republic. Indeed, one of the reasons David Trimble signed the agreement was that he believed correctly that it was better for unionists to have some participation in these processes rather than for them to happen anyway. I think if one looks in a coldly realistic light at the options available to the British state in the event of a breakdown in the agreement, I think the pattern of public policy that would be developed is along the lines I've just suggested. And that again, of course, becomes a powerful argument for David Trimble against unionist critics. It is very interesting to see that David Trimble has been using the language not of Peter Mandelson, things can only get better, but instead, this is as good as it gets. He's actually been using, you don't associate David Trimble with pop songs or phrases like that, but that's the argument he's making. If you don't make this agreement, it's going to be a hell of a lot worse for us. Now, that means he's got a much more difficult selling job in his constituency than nationalists have. It would be helpful to Trimble if there were more disgruntled Republicans than there are. Yes? No, not before it begins. It must be completed. Arrangements must commence, and it must be completed within 2 years. The arrangements must commence with the formation of, after assembly elections.
Well, given that period, given the fact that the IRA has also been active during the peace process, I'd like to just introduce something that was said to Mitchell back in 1995 by the IRA.
Okay, there's a lot of questions buried in there. First of all, democracy in Ireland has been accomplished by and large either through the integration of paramilitary organisations or their gradual dissolution over time. The history and internment, yes, but it's also critical to realise that the history of the Irish Free State in the 20s and indeed in the 30s is partly one of integrating previous paramilitary organisations, politically marginalising the hardliners, and not seeking to adopt a policy of complete extermination of those organisations. The Irish Free State was much more flexible than is sometimes suggested in the rhetoric of some political activists in the Republic and in the North. Clearly, a democracy cannot function reasonably and effectively if political parties are backed by paramilitary organisations and if those organisations remain latent and likely to be used. At the moment, there's a tacit balance of power. Both loyalists, and you've only focused on Republican organisations, both loyalists and Republicans have indicated that they will not decommission in the form of surrendering to governmental authorities. Loyalists have said their failure to decommission is conditional upon a Republican failure to decommission. I think one has to ask a pointed question. Is it better to have the slow withering away of these organisations and effective policing against any actions carried out by their members, or do you require an actively negotiated process of people handing in their weapons? Now, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm sceptical of those who are confident that they do know the answer to that question. But I also think this is not as big an issue as you imagine with the voters. It's a big issue with the Democratic Unionist Party. It's not a big issue with the voters, just like the issue of prisoner release is not a big issue with the voters. It's important, it's recognised, it's salient, but it's not a be-all or end-all issue. It's not a decisive test. Decommissioning is one of the issues that could unravel the agreement, but I don't think it's the fundamental block. The big question is there sufficient support within both the nationalist and the unionist bloc to make this agreement work? Now, there's a whole range of issues that have to be tackled by both groups if the agreement is to work, and decommissioning is simply one of them. I think it's to make a fetish of the conflict after the conflict has been fundamentally addressed, to look at the technology and weapons rather than the political processes and institutions. You may. I'm sorry, that there is evidence that their actions are much less extensive than they were.
Well, you can.
Well, then you've shifted the grounds of your argument, because you're saying that whatever the superficial evidence, these organizations remain as they were and they're not going to change. Now, if that's the case, if you're right, you're going to be right. I'm not denying that. Okay? If you're right that the organizations are as they have been and they're going to sustain themselves, then that will cause a difficulty with the agreement. Okay, I acknowledge that. Yes?
How would you want to determine if groups are really fully compliant with the decommissions or not? Like, if this is the arms industry, or clandestine, and the explosives and stuff like that?
There's an international advisory body whose task is to carry out that activity, headed by General Jean de Chastelin from Canada. And there's a set of rules and procedures and a set of laws under which they can operate. The laws give amnesties to all paramilitaries who hand in their organizations. The international advisory body is available to be contacted by the paramilitary organizations, and it is part and parcel of the understandings that Sinn Féin, the UDP, and the PUP will use their best offices to ensure that actual decommissioning takes place. If you are a super optimist about the agreement, one would argue that it's in the electoral interests of both Sinn Féin, the PUP, and the UDP to make sure that their public offices in this respect are publicly noted and seen to have material effect. I think they do, both groupings, loyalist and republican movements, do stand to gain electorally from large-scale decommissioning. Whether they think they have the internal discipline and ability to do it, and to do it under immediate public pressure, that's another matter. If it's possible for judicial court actions to decide that ministers are in breach of their pledge of office, and that parties collectively are in breach of the principles of the agreement, it seems to me that that would have to be decided in a legal process. And so it's possible that you could either get an individual minister removed from office on the grounds that he or she had been directly involved in directing paramilitary activities, or alternatively that a party would be excluded from being able to nominate ministers on the grounds that it had been found before the courts to be in breach of the agreement. But I don't think any of that could have legal effect until the two-year period had been exhausted, because it would always be open to the parties to say that they were using their offices to implement the provisions on decommissioning. Yes? Well, civil society is composed of parallel societies in Northern Ireland, although there are organisations which bridge both communities. And what's interesting about the agreement is that it creates a civil society forum in the north, almost like a second chamber. It doesn't have any real power, but it will be there as a consultative and advisory body. And there's a whole host of Protestants, Catholics and others who've been actively involved in non-governmental organisations, and in effect engaging in a great deal of quasi-local governmental work. And some of them are very unhappy about the agreement, because partly because their authority will be transferred to local politicians, and partly because, correctly or arrogantly, they believe that they'd be better at running Northern Ireland than these elected politicians. But a forum will exist for them, and in addition, there may well be a parallel forum created in the Republic with regard, and it would then create a cross-border civil society forum for matters of mutual aid and cooperation. The civil society forum will be consulted, but it's not obvious that it's going to have any direct role in monitoring and entrenching the agreement. Any other? Yes.
Do you think there would have been wise to, or would be wise to in the future, hold some kind of truth and reconciliation?
Somebody was going to do a PhD on that topic. They didn't come to do it, so I don't know the answer to the question. My own sense, and it's only a personal view, is that I'm not sure that those kinds of institutions work. You get a ventilation of the absolutely understandable grievances of victims and their relatives. You don't get court actions taken against individuals who've carried out the equivalent of crimes against humanity. We are getting an amnesty process, but the amnesty is confined to those people who belong to organizations which have ceasefires. And the amnesties are conditional on good behavior. People will be readmitted to prison if they engage in any subsequent activities. So, in a way, the question is, should all those people who are being released be required to appear before Truth and Reconciliation committees? The automatic question will then come, should all the police officers and all the British Army officers and soldiers who've been involved in episodes and incidents also appear before those fora? And I think it would lead to something of a political tar baby, without, other than in some therapeutic sense, dealing with the feelings of victims. I have relatives who have suffered in the conflict, and I have friends who have had people killed. None of them express any desire to want to see their victims' killers arraigned before some kind of South African-style tribunal. But I'm only expressing a personal view. I don't know what the public view on these kinds of issues is. Yes?
What I share your argument, and agreement is deeply realistic.
Well, I have a wager with somebody that the first time Gerry Adams and David Trimble will shake hands in public is when they're in their first cabinet meeting. Looks likely that bet is going to be realized. At the moment, it's actually rather difficult for both of them, for the Ulster Unionist Party at this stage to publicly embrace or to acknowledge Sinn Féin figures would create difficulties for them in the electoral battle they're fighting with the Democratic Unionist Party. At a personal level, Trimble has no difficulties with these things. When he was a law lecturer at Queen's, he used to visit his imprisoned students, both Loyalists and Republicans, and present their marked essays to them. He's far more diligent in that respect than I can ever claim to have been. So, I hate the volume of the laughter that remark occasioned. So I don't think at a personal level Trimble's going to have any such difficulties. When he judges the moment is politically right, he will do it. I don't think people need to have good interpersonal relationships in order to work a political agreement, but clearly it helps. Yes? I don't see total pardons. I think built into the agreement is a set of, in effect, amnesties and releases on license. And a program will be implemented to release people over a two-year period. So within 2 years, all those who belong to organizations which have ceasefires, so any breach of the ceasefires can mean no more prisoners released and existing released people going back into jail. So that's a serious constraint on good paramilitary conduct. And the full rigor of the law will be applied to those belonging to organizations who do not abide by the ceasefire. And that's having some interesting impact on the INLA, the small Republican splinter organization. Its people in jail are thinking seriously about whether they want to rot there for 20, 30 years. So I think the balance of incentives is about right there. Yes, Ian. I think there will be losers in the security community, particularly in the police. The British government is very aware of this and envisages generous payoffs. Any serious restructuring of the police that will be satisfactory to nationalists will almost certainly require at least a two-tier structure. That would create downsizing of the RUC and wouldn't conflict with legal employment rights. And I suspect, therefore, the British government will bite the bullet, so to speak, and pay generous redundancy settlements to the police. The good behavior of the police can partially be guaranteed by their pension requirements. Good conduct requires them to behave in legal ways, otherwise they lose their pensions. The paramilitaries, who are incapable of doing other jobs, are a problem. There are lots of competent paramilitaries who will become respectable members of their respective societies. There are some who are not. My sad perspective on this is that one sign of a resolution of the conflict will be that ordinary criminality will increase. Northern Ireland has had a lower rate of quote-unquote ordinary crime than other parts of the UK. That's partly because of the communal policing, quotation marks, carried out by the paramilitaries. Now, if those organizations are wound down and the discipline attached to them wound down, even though you might find that language odd, I would expect a rise in ordinary criminality, but not of such a severe nature as to disrupt the settlement. The big losers are the mono-national and mono-cultural groups. Paisleyism was about the preservation of the 1688 Constitution. It's about preserving Ulster as a special place that is more British than the British. It's the Paisleyites who stand most to lose, both in terms of their image of what Northern Ireland should be and in access to political power and decision making. The Republican community loses less because it can argue that it has achieved a significant improvement on the status quo, although many people will say to them correctly that those changes could have been accomplished without those methods being adopted. So the big losers, which is why they're the most fierce opponents, are the Paisleyites. Well, thank you very much for this vibrant session, and